it allows an alternative avenue from typical clinical medicine that's still patient-facing, as you mentioned, and making a difference in the development of medicine without being as grueling and as emotionally taxing as most other avenues of medicine tend to be. The fact that every drug, every device, every medical advancement has to go through clinical trials, there's a wealth of work out there. Having worked with patients who had certain medical conditions and now being on the other side, involved in the development of the treatments and being actively involved in the trials, it's just a wonderful opportunity and one that I don't think a lot of doctors even know exists.
Are you a health professional wanting to explore all the options life has to offer? Then you've come to the right place. The Balanced Medics Handover podcast is all about living outside the box of what we've been told. I'm Isabella, your host, a junior doctor from Australia and trained coach. I'll be interviewing health professionals from all walks of life, artists, authors, non-clinical specialists, and more. These stories show that our choices are endless. Let's take the journey together. This is The Handover. Hello and welcome back to the Balanced Medics Handover podcast. Today I have my friend on, Dr. Mary Magdy, who is a principal investigator. So some of you may not have heard of this term or this role, so it would be really great to chat about this and show all the other options we have as doctors out there within and outside clinical medicine. So Dr. Mary Magdy is PGY4 and currently working in this job and can shed some more light on this. We met when I was also working in clinical research. I was a sub-investigator, so we can have a bit of a discussion in that way. Without further ado, let's hand over to Mary. Hey, Mary, how are you?
I'm good, Isabella. How are you?
Yeah, good. Well, now we start every episode with the same question. Can you share your journey? How did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, so you sort of touched on it. I completed my internship and residency about 4 years ago. Completed my internship 4 years ago. And then after I finished residency, I found that I wasn't 100% set on any particular pathway. I was leaning towards the medical terms. They were the terms that I enjoyed the most during those years. And so I was sort of tossing up between physician's training and general practice, and speaking to, you know, other doctors. It seemed like physician's training was quite a grueling path. And so I was a bit torn between what I wanted to do. There are a few doctors in my family and a couple of my brothers had locumed post their residency. And so they had suggested, you know, if you're uncertain, wanted more experience and some freedom for a little while, then locuming would be a good option. So I ended up going down that pathway. And rightfully so, that, as they said, I loved the freedom aspect and the opportunity to try new things. And one of those job opportunities was within clinical research. And so I gave it a go as a locum initially for a month trial basis, and then found that I quite enjoyed it. And so I went back to the hospital for a few months and then decided to continue in clinical research. And so I started doing that full time.
Yeah, that's really great to share. So you mentioned how you got into clinical research. So what drew you to say yes to that job and leave the hospital?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I wasn't actually super sure about what clinical research entailed at the time that I decided to give it a try. I thought it was just a month. I'll see what it's like. Some of the aspects that were appealing based on the description that was given to me was, you know, it's an office job as opposed to working in the hospital. At that time, I was signing up to all kinds of different gigs, and so I thought, okay, this might be a bit different. And then what drew me sort of towards research was the fact that it's the future of medicine. Largely my exposure to research had been in terms of a theoretical aspect as opposed to a practical one, and so being given the opportunity to experience it in a practical sense was appealing. And it was just a month, you know, so in terms of stakes, it was low stakes, low risk, possible high reward, which thankfully it turned out to be. I also liked that the hours were a bit shorter, so they were about 8 hour shifts, and at the time I was doing a lot of 12 hour hospital shifts, and so there were some additional factors that weren't specific to research that sort of drew me towards it as well.
Yeah, that's really great. Thank you for sharing that and how you kind of gave it a go without really knowing what it would be like, but it did pay off. Now, I think the listeners are probably wondering, what is clinical research? Because research, I think for a lot of doctors, means the writing a grant, doing a PhD, that kind of research. But the one that we're talking about is a bit different. So can you share what clinical research is?
I guess there are many different ways to define clinical research. I think to put it very simply, it's essentially medical research that's carried out through clinical trials. I think keeping in mind the target audience and what's important to them to know in terms of what you'll be doing if you're working within clinical research, I guess you'll be dealing with a range of trials and patients that are on different trials. So they can be observational studies, interventional studies, and ultimately the aim is to aid in understanding the treatments, the screening, diagnosis, and prevention of specific medical conditions. And so these trials can be on, you know, medications or devices. And so speaking, you know, for example, about medications, every drug from paracetamol to the latest life-altering oncology medications has gone through clinical trials at different stages, at different dosages. These trials aim to initially demonstrate the safety, efficacy, and tolerability of a product. And then as it progresses, you know, they, in later phases, they see how it compares potentially to other already available drugs that are marketed for that treatment. And so they're looking to see if it's non-inferior, superior, things like that. And so what we're doing is we're working with the participants on these trials to obtain the data to be provided to help determine the results of a specific study.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary of like abroad what it could entail. In terms of your job, what sort of trials do you largely work with?
Yeah, so in my current role, we're working mainly with healthy volunteers in later phase studies. We have done some, you know, early phase 1 trials, but it's predominantly in a generalist capacity. In later phase, some of the trials could be vaccines, you know, such as COVID, influenza, some management of chronic medical conditions such as hypercholesterolemia, obesity. So there's, you know, a huge area at the moment, as I'm sure you're aware, of trials that are happening for treatment of type 2 diabetes, obesity. And so I'm tending to work in a generalist capacity given my background. But there are all kinds of areas of therapeutic interest and different clinics and places that specifically work, for example, just a phase 1 unit or specific areas that would cover different phases, different types of trials.
Yeah, that's really great to share that it is primarily healthy volunteers, and there are a lot of sites in Australia, in Sydney alone. So for people listening, if you research clinical research in your area, you could be surprised at how many clinics are up there. And in terms of phase 1 trials, I think those ones, people sometimes stay inpatient from my experience to get the medication and have like regular blood testing. And it's a bit more hands-on certain phase 1 trials. And this is also separate to oncology trials, which is a whole other thing in itself. And I think usually you need an oncology background for those kind of trials. Now, I just wanted to clear up something else. So like I said earlier, most people might think research is about asking for grants and applying for funding. This is different what we're talking about. So can you tell us more about who is funding this research and how that is different?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you mentioned, it's dependent on the type of site that you're working in. So whether this is a public hospital, you know, potentially affiliated with a university. My experience has been in a private clinical research site where the funding is provided by a sponsor. And more often than not, the sponsor is the one that came up with the investigational product. And so they may employ a contract research organization or a CRO to aid in monitoring of the trial, or at times they will act as the CRO essentially, and so they will just work directly with you. but there's all kinds of rules and regulations about that.
Yeah, that's really great. So it's like the drug companies essentially are the ones funding this research. So it's one less thing to worry about for people that like research out there. You're not the one campaigning to get money for this. There is money here. Now I wanted to ask about your role, principal investigator. What is a principal investigator? And also, what is a sub-investigator?
Yeah, sure. So within a clinical research team, there are certain staff who are needed to run the trial. Largely, this involves a doctor. So there will be a principal investigator who essentially accepts responsibility of the conduct of the trial, and then they will delegate to different staff. So some of the standard staff that are included would be a coordinator. Often on blinded trials, there's an unblinded personnel that could be either a pharmacist or a nurse who's in charge of preparing and often administering an investigational product if that's within that particular trial. The coordinator role covers a scope of things, and it's dependent on the way the organisation is set up, but they'll do things such as recruit patients onto the trial, potentially collect bloods and do ECGs. They also input data into a platform called the EDC, where you'll give sponsor access to redacted information obtained from the site. Sometimes the roles are split and the coordinator doesn't perform all of those tasks. And so, you know, there might be additional personnel such as a lab personnel, blood collector, that kind of thing. And then to answer specifically your question about the doctor roles, there's, as I mentioned, the principal investigator who oversees everything. Then there's the sub-investigators who don't accept full responsibility of the trial, but work day to day with the principal investigator and the staff that I'd mentioned in order to see the patients on the trial. And whilst they don't retain the same amount of responsibility as the principal investigator, they are responsible for their own conduct and to ensure, in accordance with good clinical practice guidelines, that they maintain the rights, well-being and safety of the participants that are on that trial. If you're looking sort of towards what the day-to-day job entails, it's dependent on the type of trial and where we are in the time point of that trial. So you may be joining a clinical research site that has studies that are halfway through. And so you'll be sort of dealing with follow-up visits. But if we were to start from the very beginning of a trial and have a sub-investigator join right when it was starting up, then essentially you would have patients who are being seen initially for something that's called a screening visit. So that screening visit is the first point of contact that a doctor would have with a participant that could potentially join a trial. Screening periods can range from, you know, just a month to years, essentially. So that screening visit, that first one, the very first thing that should occur is to obtain informed consent from the patient. It's a lengthy process, informed consent within a clinical trial. It's quite unlike what most doctors are used to with a very quick consent that you may have witnessed in the hospital setting. This can take well over an hour. It's an extremely important aspect of clinical trials, and it's crucial that it's conducted appropriately and correctly. I know it's quite extensive, so I won't go through every single detail, but some of the things that would be discussed, you go through an informed consent form, which is about 20 to 25 pages. It outlines an introduction, the purpose of the trial, the study design, the visit schedule. You discuss what the participant expectations are, possible restrictions. For example, you know, patients might not be able to donate blood whilst on the trial, what contraceptive requirements there may be, information about the sponsor, the pharmaceutical company that you'd referenced previously, the CRO if it's applicable, what happens to the patient's lab samples, and all kinds of further information. You need to discuss the risks and possible benefits of the investigational product or of being on the trial. And you would provide them information about, you know, ethics committee, who to approve the study, who to contact and how, and give them the opportunity to ask any questions and ensure that they've got capacity and fully comprehend what's involved in participating in the trial. After that, you would document that entire process. If the patient had, you know, agreed to come onto the trial, you'd sign and date to the form individually and then document the process. following on from that, so that's quite a large portion of the visit, then you'd go through the inclusion and exclusion criteria, which needs to be assessed for each participant to determine whether they're eligible to enroll. You also need to obtain a comprehensive medical history, go through their medications that they've previously taken, and information that you'd obtain also includes their demographics, depending on the trial, maybe their vaccination history, and certain details that you might need to obtain specific to the trial. Following on from this, you'd usually do a set of vitals. You'd physically examine them, and the systems that you would examine are dependent on the trial and what's in the protocol, which is a specific set of instructions that you would follow to the T and don't deviate from the protocol. And then again, it'll be dependent on the trial, but often you'd be doing an ECG and interpreting it, potentially taking their bloods, doing a urine test. And so it's dependent on what type of trial you're dealing with, because sometimes the screening visit, that initial one, can actually be combined with the next visit, which is referenced as the baseline visit, where usually the patient is given the investigational product. But that's largely dependent on the type of trial. So COVID and influenza vaccine trials with healthy volunteers, often that's okay to just proceed and combine the two, because you're not waiting on specific results such as imaging or blood results to ensure eligibility. But if it's a treatment-based trial and you need to get that confirmation, then it may be split. So that's day-to-day what happens with a screening visit, which is usually quite an extensive one. Following on from those, you often are following up patients on a trial. So you would be assessing patient safety with a review of any adverse events that may have occurred, concomitant medication use that you'd be documenting, vitals, doing another physical exam, urine and blood tests again. I'm generalizing, and it's study specific, and there's usually always a schedule of activities within a protocol that exactly determines what procedures are required and who is required to do it, whether it's an investigator or a coordinator or exactly which personnel are permitted to perform those tasks. Otherwise, your day-to-day activities would be interpreting results, so the bloods occur at the safety follow-ups, reviewing the patient progress, aiding with resolution of queries that may arise throughout the day from a coordinator or a monitor, who is someone who comes to monitor the trial, as the name indicates, or the sponsors. And so I think that's a rough overview of the general workload of a sub-investigator. A principal investigator has other requirements in terms of being a lot more involved in, selecting the types of trials that may be run, in attending meetings where they're required, in discussing with the monitors during a monitoring visit. You tend to have problems escalated to you, essentially, and so you'll be making medical decisions about, sometimes the treatment of a patient, whether they're continuing within a study, attending meetings in earlier phases where there's safety review committees. And so there's a whole other realm of the principal investigator role. But I think for most people starting out as a sub-investigator, that's a pretty a general overview of what you might be encountering.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary of the day-to-day. And I guess the key thing is that it is patient-facing, healthy volunteer facing. So you are seeing people, examining them, getting histories. And like you mentioned, it's very protocol driven. There's a very big document that has all the information you need, and basically you follow what's laid out in that documentation for who can and can't be on a trial. And like you said, principal investigators do more than that, but usually people do start as a sub-investigator if they have no experience, and then from training go into a PI or principal investigator job. Now, for you, what are the highlights of working as a principal investigator in clinical research?
Yeah, I think clinical research as a whole is very interesting. It's a niche area of medicine that I feel lucky to have stumbled upon. It's a different form of aiding the community, often a reason why doctors choose to pursue this career. And it provides the opportunity to be actively involved in the development of treatments and interventions for medical conditions that you would have seen firsthand when you were in a hospital setting. And so it allows an alternative avenue from typical clinical medicine that's still patient-facing, as you mentioned, and making a difference in the development of medicine without being as grueling and as emotionally taxing as most other avenues of medicine tend to be. I think the fact that every drug, every device, every medical advancement has to go through clinical trials, there's a wealth of work out there. And when you see the difference that these interventions can make in so many different ways, in so many different fields, as you mentioned, oncology set units, or even in the treatment and prevention of infectious diseases, it's just astounding. And having worked with patients who had certain medical conditions and now being on the other side involved in the development of the treatments and being actively involved in the trials, it's just a wonderful opportunity and one that I don't think a lot of doctors even know exists. I think working in the hospital during COVID and completing, you know, internship and residency throughout that period, seeing firsthand the improvement in morbidity and mortality due to COVID vaccines, it was amazing. And it was all completed, you know, all this research very quickly in a short space of time. And so I think it showed firsthand the effects of research in a very modern sense and not that long ago. So, yeah, I think that they're things that made me very interested in the area. I think some of the highlights are seeing the patients. That was something that I worried about in doing a non-clinical role per se. But this is almost the best of both worlds, especially working in a facility where you're dealing with healthy volunteer patients predominantly, or patients who, you know, have a stable chronic medical condition such as hypercholesterolemia or osteoarthritis. And so it's almost a breath of fresh air compared to some of the other jobs out there.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. It's a lot less high pressure and high stakes. So maybe it's not a job for someone that likes that kind of adrenaline rush. I think the only thing you would really need to do is if there was an like anaphylactic reaction or something like that, that's when, yeah, maybe you will have to do some sort of emergency response. I think phase one is a little bit more intense as well, from what I've heard, that they might have a few adverse reactions every a year, you know, in different trials, but in the later phases, it's quite unlikely. So you can have that pressure relief, and also GP. So you're not a GP in this. Like, if there's medical issues, you do refer people to their GP. So you also aren't in charge of the medical care.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you mentioned, it's usually in an emergency setting that you do. The most common worry would be anaphylaxis, but there may be, you know, typical with other, even vaccine clinics, a lot of vasovagals. Patients who have presyncopal symptoms during venipuncture or during administration of the investigational product, or an immediate reaction, not necessarily anaphylaxis. So there is some occurrences where you are intervening in a medical sense and treating the patient, but as you mentioned, you're treating them in a trial capacity, not in terms of a holistic general practice manner.
Yeah, exactly. Now we've spoken about the highlights. What are like lowlights? What's the things that maybe aren't your favorite about clinical research?
I think this may not necessarily be my issues with it, but from what I've gathered, some people tend to struggle with the pedanticness of this industry. I'm not going to lie, I do love that aspect of it, Isabella, but some people don't. It's, you know, as you mentioned, following a strict protocol, there's a lot of restrictions, even about the way to document things, how to link the indications of certain concomitant medications, understanding the difference between what goes as medical history versus an adverse event. And I feel a lot of doctors sometimes are disputing the rationale that's being presented to them. So I think that's, it's a very particular job and quite different to other jobs in medicine, where you're not restricted with how you document and you have full autonomy. And so I don't think it's for everyone in that regard. I guess it's just dependent on your style, and that's one aspect. The other qualm that a lot of people tend to have is, as you mentioned in the prior question, it was it's not the typical adrenaline rush by any means of an emergency department or life-saving surgery gig, or, you know, it's an entirely different pace, a different focus, and that may not be appreciated by some individuals, but it may be loved by others.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary. And yeah, I think if you like protocols, if you like these guidelines and sticking with those rules, it's something that probably could scratch that itch. But if you're one that isn't loving those kind of details, it's very detail oriented, very, you know, by the book. There's no room for being a cowboy here, I guess. And in the hospital, sometimes people get away with not the best documentation or consent documentation, but here it's like very strict. Like, people review what you do, and there's auditing processes, and a lot of sites do get audited, especially if you see a lot of patients, which I know a lot of sites do get a lot of patients, so that's something to keep in mind. Now, who's eligible to work as a principal investigator? Do you need a specialty? Do you need full medical registration?
Yeah. I think I'll start with sub-investigator, if that's okay. I think technically everyone is eligible in terms of, you know, if you have your general registration and you're working in a doctor capacity. But depending on the clinic or pharmaceutical company that you're pursuing a role in, and depending on the therapeutic area, there may be restrictions. So as you mentioned before, the oncology trials, they, you know, opt to have an oncologist or an oncology trainee running in those clinics or in that pharmaceutical industry. In terms of a general capacity, sort of like the role that I have working in a generalist role, general registration, and then if you have any previous research experience, that would be great, but not necessary, as was the case with both of us. And so I think from that perspective, technically anyone's eligible. However, it's the people that have the extreme attention to detail, are very organized, like structure, and potentially have an avid interest in research that make up the perfect concoction of someone who would thrive in this industry. I think also people who tend to go down an alternate route may not be happy in their current job and may be wanting to branch out and essentially look to find another job in a different field. So, you know, individuals like that may not make up the best resume to bring forward to this industry, but they are definitely eligible, and people who may stumble into it like we have and love it.
Yeah, that's great. And I think you answered the next question already, like, who would enjoy this work? I think we've already touched on that. Someone that likes having attention to detail and following that structure. I think that's the kind of person that would really enjoy clinical research. And also, if you enjoy that, you know, 9-to-5 clinic job that's less high paced.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, is there room to grow? What would be next? I know a sub-investigator goes to principal investigator, but is there any other, is there anything else beyond that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's all kinds of avenues. I think we've been very focused on working in a clinical research site because that's the role that we've either previously been or actively are in. But there's all kinds of jobs within the industry. There's working within the pharmaceutical companies. Within that, you could work as a medical monitor on the trial, where you work for the sponsor, the pharmaceutical company, and you answer the questions from the doctors on site in regards to eligibility, or whether, you know, if there's an intervention required for a patient that's on the trial, all kinds of things that may be escalated to you. You could work as a medical advisor, as a writer. Within the clinical research industry, there's a whole range of jobs in different capacities, in different areas. And so I think doing some research into that, finding out what each job description actually is and what it entails. Maybe you don't want to have any patient interaction, and there's opportunities for those roles within this one umbrella of clinical research. So room to grow could be progression, as you said, from a sub-investigator into a principal or a co-investigator, or it could mean working on the entire different side.
Yeah, I think that's a really great summary. And also important to mention that medical monitor and roles like in that direction can be remote as well. So I have seen roles advertised fully remote for that. So if people are wanting location freedom, that is a possibility. Now, I wanted to talk about remuneration. I think I can share. So I've seen roles ranging from 180 a year to close to 300,000 a year. So just that's, I think, the kind of typical range at the moment for those listening. So maybe 180 is more of the starter and you can go higher as you grow. And it, I think, also depends on the clinic and if it is fully private versus if it's a public clinic. Now, how could someone find out more, see if it's the right fit for them?
Yeah, I think, like we mentioned, doing some research into pharmaceutical companies, into the job descriptions. I think, platforms like LinkedIn, where there's a lot of jobs that are out there, and you could speak to locum agencies. So I've seen advertisements for, working in clinical trials in all kinds of areas, not just within Sydney or New South Wales, but interstate as well. And reading about the different roles, I think, can help guide you in terms of what suits you personally. And then if you're interested in clinical research as a whole, I think Good Clinical Practice GCP guidelines is a great place to give you this foundation. It's a compulsory requirement for anyone working within the field. So it's a great place to start. And honestly, if you just do a Google search, you will go down a rabbit hole of information that could be provided about clinical research as a whole. And then you could specify your search to be, different doctor roles that are within it.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm glad you mentioned Good Clinical Practice, because I was thinking I should say that. So it's good you brought that up. So if you do get the certificate in GCP, that's a great thing on your resume if you do want to get one of these jobs, because it's one less thing for them to train you in. It's not compulsory, like they can still hire you and then get you like in training to do it on the first day on the job. A way that I have like found some options for work as well is sending your resume to clinics like that. Just looking up a clinical research clinic, sending the resume, asking if they're interested, and people do get back to you. So that's another option. And yeah, agents like MedRecruit is what I think we both use, and they have a lot of different options, but every agency has options for non-clinical jobs if you ask them.
Yeah. And I think by the same premise, not just the sites, if you speak to a pharmaceutical company itself, it's all kinds, especially the CROs or the contract research organisations that help run the trial on behalf of the sponsor, because they're locally situated, often have an office within a region where you might be, and you could sort of communicate with them to see what roles are open and what you could apply for.
Yes, that's a great point as well. So everyone listening, get on the internet, research, see what's out there for you. There's so many options out there that we're just sometimes not even aware of. Now, I ask this of everyone, what is balance to you?
I think it's finding a happy medium where your work life and your life outside of work is balanced and you feel in control. I think something I've found, especially after working in a field where I enjoy it, it's that if you find a job that's enjoyable and rewarding, it can really change how you feel when you feel whether you're balanced or not. I think oftentimes medicine can be quite anxiety provoking at baseline, and then there's additional stresses confounding it. And so being aware of that and learning how to limit it helps with feeling balanced and grounded. There's all kinds of uncertainty and worry that doctors face on a daily basis. And so I think having those external factors outside of work, a supportive network, faith and religion, extracurricular activities, hobbies, all of those things externally help keep you level-headed. And being self-aware of, when you're getting stressed out and knowing how to combat that. I think that's a whole process in itself, but being able to master that, I think, would greatly aid with helping feel, making, like helping you feel balanced. So yeah, I think may not be entirely answering your question there, but
yeah, that's there's no right or wrong. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah, I think you're right about your self-awareness is so important. And then finding the place that can light you up and give you that space. So like, for example, you going to clinical research from the hospital has opened up your time to look after yourself and you enjoy it a lot more. So that's just an example of how you found more balance. Now, is there anything else you'd like to add that you think would benefit the listeners?
No, I think we've covered it all.
All right, great. We've covered it all. So I guess I just want to remind everyone that there's so many jobs out there that you might not even be aware of. Like we both stumbled, Mary and I both stumbled on this job kind of by accident or just by, I don't know about you, but I asked for a non-clinical job and that's how I got offered it. I think they just offered it to you. Is that right? And you said, why not?
Yeah, I hadn't actually specified non-clinical. It was just an opportunity.
Yeah, and we just kind of said yes to this thing, gave it a go, and it just opens up your eyes to how there is a lot of jobs out there beyond the hospital and beyond training programs that you might just not know of. So I just wanted to highlight that to everyone. Now, are you okay for people to reach out to you?
I'm happy for people to reach out to me. Probably via LinkedIn would probably be the best way. Yep. I think, I know this whole talk has been about research, but on that note of you mentioning all kinds of jobs that are out there, I think meeting quite a few people along the locoming journey, there's a whole other realm even outside of clinical research in terms of, you know, vaccination clinics or in terms of working in private health insurance, and there's all these kinds of avenues that a lot of people who haven't been satisfied within the hospital have managed to find. I just happened, and I think you have to like clinical research. But even if you don't end up liking that, or it doesn't seem like an industry you want to delve into, there's a whole other range of jobs that are out there that are similar in terms of, you know, their hours and the office job and that kind of thing. So even if clinical research isn't exactly what you were hoping for, then there's other similar avenues that are out there too.
Yeah, that's really great. And so I'll put your LinkedIn in the show notes. And on that note as well, a lot of these jobs can keep your registration, your medical registration too, if that's something you're interested in. So that's, I think that's everything in a nutshell. I think we covered most of the important points. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's been great.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Balance Medics Handover podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, I'd love for you to take a minute to rate and review this podcast and click the follow button. For more resources, check out the Balance Medics website. The link to this will be in the show notes below. See you next episode.